Hello, hello. It's Jacob Hill with GRC Academy. Today, I'm here with a wonderful panel from various universities. Very happy they're here today. Thank you all for coming on. In a moment, we'll introduce you. Folks, before we do that, if you are enjoying the podcast, please take a moment to like, comment, share, subscribe, all the great things. Really helps me out. Appreciate it. Thank you again for coming on. Really appreciate your time. And we'll start ladies first. Wendy, why don't you introduce yourself?
Okay. Hi, everybody. I am Wendy Epley, and I'm a principal analyst at the University of Arizona within the Information Security Office Governance Risk and Compliance team. And I've worked in regulatory compliance for over 15 years. My career in that field started at a global aerospace and defense company. But for the last 12 years, I've worked in higher education. I maintain certifications as an export compliance professional, a certified CMMC professional. I'm also an advanced registered practitioner for CMMC. And I'm also working on my CMMC instructor certification. So I guess you can say I like learning. But in my spare time, I am also the deputy managing director for the American Sanctions and Export Control Society.
Awesome. Thank you for joining us. Melissa, why don't you introduce yourself?
Wendy, I can relate to enjoying education and learning. While pursuing my PhD here at the University of Maine, I overlapped quite a bit with the folks that I currently work with. And it was through that they reached out to me and said, hey, we have this position. It's a research data security analyst. We think that you'd be a good fit. Could you please apply? That's why I'm here now. So I am still working on the PhD on the side, but I'm in the Advanced Research Computing Security and Information Management Unit. My work overlaps quite a bit with the Information Security Office, where I'm an adjunct member of that team. I do anything from reviewing contracts like pre-award, post-award, and cybersecurity clauses there to project management related to CMMC compliance, which, as we all know at this point, is NIST SB 800-171 stuff. And right now, a lot of the things I'm doing is also preparing for NSPM 33.
Excellent. Thank you. Jay, go ahead.
Sure. I'm Jay Gallman. I am a risk advisor on the IT security office at Duke University. I've worked in higher ed all my life, which is several many decades, and we'll leave it at that for now. The past decade plus has been more of a security focus and been focused on NIST 800-171 since the DFARS clause introduced it in about 2015. A couple of years ago, EDUCAUSE decided to spin up a group around SB 800-171 compliance that meets on a monthly basis, and I've been a co-chair on that. Wendy joined me in that role this fall, so there's a lot of us in higher ed who talk about this, not only in that forum, talk about it in a place called the Regulator Research Community of Practice, which is an NSF-funded program. And so the only way I think some of us are surviving is through this coping mechanism we have in these various groups to talk to one another and see who's doing what and how it's working out.
Excellent. Thank you. Colin, go ahead.
Hi, I'm Colin Hodson. I am the Research Security and Compliance Program Manager for the University of Notre Dame. Before that, I was the manager of the Information Security Group, and before that, a senior analyst in that group. So about 14 years here at Notre Dame in cybersecurity. So I come to it from the cybersecurity side of things rather than the compliance side of things. Before that, I worked in banking and healthcare before that. And of course, there's regulation in all those industries. So my compliance training comes through practical skills of making hospitals and banks compliant for their various compliant requirements. 2015 was the year I was first familiarized with NIST 800-171. Our research group here at the Universities of Notre Dame came to the IT group and said, hey, here's this compliance thing. What do we have to do? And we said, well, we're pretty invested in cloud right now, so we're going to look for a cloud answer. And the cloud answer was AWS GovCloud. In 2016, we built out CUI compliance systems. And by the 2018 deadline, we had all our CUI projects working in AWS GovCloud. So I co-led that effort, and that's how I ended up with you guys.
Well, excellent. Thank you so much again for coming on. Really looking forward to the conversation. So let's start by shifting into the world of universities. I have a small business background. I've been working around DoD for quite a while. Right now, I'm the director of cyber operations at a small business. I feel like there's a lot of differences between that that and universities. So just helping me understand in my audience the basic organizational structure of a university. Could one of you speak to that?
I could. I think all of us would tell you that a university is more like a municipality, a small city, a collection of businesses. So as where you're one small business, think of every college and school we have as being a business. Think of our financial operations as being a bank. Think of our student health services being a hospital type of an operation. We run a athletics program, and so we've got those sorts of things. We house students. Some of us actually have actual hotels as part of our portfolio. And so there's a lot going on. And in most cases, you're looking at that being on a distributed network that's all interconnected in one way or another. And so parsing it out to the individual business level can be a tricky thing.
And I think municipality is a great term because many larger institutions also have police departments. You know, we have campus safety that needs to happen. And I know, Colin, you've got a fire department, don't you?
And a post office.
And a post office, yeah.
And 60 restaurants on campus and a 5-star hotel and a stadium that holds 80,000 people. And we have 120,000 visitors on campus on football game days. And coming from other industries, I was absolutely stunned at all of the various things that are going on all at once on the same network, trying to follow the same guidelines and rules. It's a huge challenge.
Recently, a presentation, something that was really compelling that was said there, was they said that fundamentally, universities are open. It's all about being open, collaborative. It's not about being closed. Whereas, say, like a defense industrial-based contractor, it's you walk in the door, you're in a closed building, it's restricted access. Like, that's the vibe, right? It's, you know, it makes me think of very Foucault, right? You kind of operate within your constructs that you're in. I know that's a little out there, but if you go into an environment and it's fundamentally restricted versus you go into an environment where it's the exact opposite of that, it's really hard to culturally convey, to get that cultural shift and to convey that you have a difference and you need to start acting differently in this environment when you walk around. And that's just not what people do. Shifting that mindset is really challenging in the academic setting.
Wow. Well, that's very interesting. Now, I was doing a little bit of research on a university structure, and tell me if I got this right. So from a basic, extremely basic standpoint, university at the top, then you have the colleges and schools underneath, and then you have departments and all of those. Is that correct?
A little bit. That's great for the academic side of the house, but then you've got basically most universities are divided into an academics and research kind of a portfolio with the items that you just mentioned. Then you've got the business side of the house that handles some of the other things that we've talked about. And in Colin's case, it would probably be handling his dining operations. It would be handling the post office. It would be handling the facilities that we all have. And so there's two large stacks that are taking place in there.
Yeah, understood. Thank you. And right, just for my understanding, when we talk about budget and, for example, compliance, cyber compliance budget, where at what level is that actually authorized?
It depends. It really does depend. It depends on the unit, depends on the school, but you could say generally it's going to be at a leadership level. You have an office of budget or finance that ultimately is going to disperse where the funds are at. But just like an organization, you've got a budget that each leader has to fight for to keep and to expand upon. If you're a public institution like the University of Arizona, then there's an even higher authority above the university president where budgets may need to be negotiated from. So it really does depend.
And I think that another thing to consider there is a lot of DFAR 7012, their contract, right? You get in a contract. So those contracts are the responsibility of typically principal investigator. So they have their budget, and then a percentage of that goes toward the base budget, right? And that base budget, the indirect costs, right, that they call it, is a separate pool of money, whereas the researcher is using that the rest of that contract grant or whatever toward whatever they need to do for compliance. And it really depends on your institution. In some institutions, it might be that indirect monies is going toward funding their compliance efforts. In other institutions, it may be that the researcher themselves are responsible for paying the extra amount to make sure that they have compliance systems.
Colin, you'd mentioned different types of compliance that universities have to deal with already. Can you give us some examples of those?
Yeah, so it kind of makes your head spin. The last time I counted, there were almost 300 different kinds of compliance. Things were a lot simpler at a bank because we have a lot of the bank's compliance, as well as NCAA has its own compliance rules. As Jay mentioned, you have medical facilities on campus. So now you have HIPAA as well. You have FERPA because that's what governs student data. You also have Gramm-Leach-Bliley. Essentially, since you're encompassing all these different verticals, you inherit the compliance for all of those verticals. And like Jay said, we've got a single network, the backbone anyway, of a network that connects all things because we need that to survive. So when you impose all those different compliance requirements on it, it becomes a very complicated picture very quickly.
We've got, so all of us have got PCI compliance to deal with. I think another thing that several of us are starting to deal with is we're starting to see regulations being developed at the state levels. And so we're finding that as we deal with, say, data from a state department here in North Carolina, that they have their regulations that they want to attach. And so not only are we seeing a breadth of regulations, but we're seeing variation in some of the same regulations being applied at a number of levels. And so it's kind of a force multiplier effect, and not necessarily in a good way from a trying to keep your hands around it perspective.
Yeah, that's a good point, because even though at the federal level, there's been an attempt for uncontrolled data, controlled unregulated data, to be consistent across federal agencies, no such thing has happened with state agencies. I've actually been in meetings with state officials, and they've asked us to be compliant with a couple of hundred different standards all at the same time by naming it in the contract, all NIST 800 series compliance. You're responsible for that. And it's impossible to do. You just can't. And it actually said that in the contract draft. You know, I was sitting there in disbelief. No one does it. There's no one on earth that can be compliant with all of those standards. We need to come to an agreement about what we're going to actually do. So when Jay said, yes, states, oh man, the variation there is, the variance across states is just mind-boggling. Controlled, wow, unclassified. Did they ever get to the actual words, controlled unclassified? Just checking.
Wow. Well, from a small business perspective, well, you got the DoD with their requirements, but then you have other agencies with their different cybersecurity requirements, incident response being one of them, Veterans Affairs, report incidents within 1 hour of discovery or suspicion of an incident, you know, things like that. But I do not envy your position at all with all of those various compliance requirements. I'm glad it's Friday for you too.
And Jacob, just to be clear too, those are just the actual regulatory things we can point to. We also get contractual things just written in the contract. They're not citing a particular regulation or standard. It's just enumerated requirements that they want you to follow, yeah, that you're supposed to keep track of.
Right. Which may not always point to a specific standard or framework. This may just be their own requirement.
Yeah, I was looking at a contract that came our way, and it had some really interesting requirements that said if you use cloud, it's got to be a community cloud. That's odd. People who want services really need to be careful what they write into their contracts, but especially for government. Obviously, we'll talk about this, but with CMMC, if they overmark, you know, for example, we have that problem with CUI of the government just marking CUI when it's not. I think there will be a lot of contracts that we'll see with CMMC level 2 requirements just in case, you know, that type of thing. So, but we'll get into that in a moment. Let's talk about, from the university standpoint, who's involved in the execution of a DoD contract and more from a project standpoint.
I can start.
You're laughing, Melissa. You take this one.
Sure. It's going to sound probably maybe similar, but so at least, for example, at the University of Maine, the execution of the contract itself, right, we have an administrative office that works with the principal investigator that's on that particular contract, right? So that's the first step, right? So you have admin. Then you have folks like me in the information security office that are looking at what do these people have and what do they need? So typically that means a POAM. And if there's not an existing SSP, writing an SSP, right? That involves groups. It involves at times MSPs, managed service providers, or managed security service providers, or is it managed service security? I don't know. Either way, MSSP, sure. Right? So top down, because we're dealing with large amounts of money, right? It's pretty involved across departments. And it requires that collaborative effort and knowing your peers and then feeling secure that the staff that are going to be working on these projects are following policies and procedures. And then what you have in place to essentially audit them and to monitor what they're currently doing and ensuring that they are following what they're saying they're doing. So it's very cyclical and very involved, but others can chime in there on the execution part.
I think it's also important to note that just because a contract is coming from the DoD does not mean that it's controlled and classified information. There are some institutions who will not accept contracts that negate the fundamental research exclusion provision. And so if there are any restrictions on who can participate on a research, or if there are publication restrictions, or if the project involves items that require a license from another government agencies, those could be some of the characteristics that would negate that fundamental research provision that universities strive to obtain. But then there are some institutions that will accept these kinds of restrictions, but not work on something that's considered classified, because you have to be a cleared facility for that. That's a whole nother animal in itself. So I think it's important to understand too that the DoD contracts come in many shapes and sizes and flavors. Who gets involved and how those contracts are executed, there's a lot of moving pieces to that puzzle that have to be examined and examined closely to understand how they all fit.
A lot of different groups on campus are involved. And for a university, if you're looking at a DoD contract that has some restrictions, or rather some requirements, whether it's 800-171 or something that's less complicated, we're going to be calling on a couple different groups that exist already on campus in order to execute that contract. You're going to have, if you're have on site or whether it's in the cloud, you're going to have engineers that are required to build those systems. You're going to have people that will design the input and output of those systems so you can get data in, get data out. You're going to need services like identity management so that you can log in through username and password and MFA. You're going to need cybersecurity folks so that there's an incident handling plan. You're going to need the services that do backup and restore just in case you have a disaster or business recovery situation. So you're going to be calling on a lot of people all across campus for that one contract to be fulfilled.
Disaster response not required for CMMC.
Oh, you guys just skipped that?
I'm being facetious. It's just not in there.
So you're right. That's not a compliance requirement. That's an institutional requirement.
I think one of the things that all these comments point out, though, is the fact that it varies depending on what the project is. It also means that we have developed this very labyrinth of things, and keeping track of who knows about what or who needs to know what. I think historically, universities have done a lot of their workflow in email, and we have far gotten beyond what we can do with email as a workflow management tool. And so I think a lot of us are struggling with, where do we have a management resource that all of the people who need to potentially touch this can get at it, and then collaboratively identify who else needs to be involved? Because right now, at least in our institute, often an ad hoc thing where somebody sees something and says, oh, so-and-so needs to be involved. And it's not a repeatable process. It's kind of like it comes in and then starts tumbling its way through the system, hoping to get to the right places along the way, which is not exactly an efficient way of doing things. And so I think managing that workflow is now something that all of us are grappling with. What's the best way to do it?
Our grant administrator started using a software that was supposed to help that process, but it was kind of tone deaf to the compliance side of things with regard to like information security or export control check. It's a much needed thing. And if there was something that we didn't have to pay for that was developed through, say, like an NSF grant or something. I don't know. That would be wonderful.
Right. So it sounds like you all are pretty isolated from the folks who are administrating the systems, as well as the users, faculty, staff, students actually operating on the contracts. With that said, how would a incident actually flow up to you all? And would you report that, or is that someone else who would be responsible for incident reporting?
I think there's the incident reporting piece and there's the incident handling piece to consider in this. At Duke, it would be incumbent on security and the tools that we have in place to monitor, probably identify a potential incident, and then to do take the necessary steps to determine whether or not it's an actual incident. We would then tee off the process and have check down list as to who needs to be contacted, and then make the right contact on behalf of the Institute. And it will vary depending on what the nature or the data that was involved in. So, you know, if we've got a piece incident, maybe that goes through our e-commerce director. If it's research for DOD, it may flow through a different path. And so it's not like there's just one entity that you can point to and say, that's the incident responder and the person who handles it. Could be a couple of people.
Right. And that's one of the advantages that most universities have. This is already a well-worn path. We've been doing incident response for many, many years. So when a DoD contract has incident response and notification as a requirement, we plug into that process. Now, that becomes a problem if a framework for compliance starts to mandate separation of the incident response process that we normally use from the one that's allowable for this DoD contract. Identity and access management is another one. We're very well versed in username, password, multi-factor authentication, multiple ways to figure out who you are, and then moving on to zero trust. That's something that's well known at universities and may not be at smaller companies. In some quarters, we're seeing the indication that we may have to duplicate that whole process just to be compliant for this contract or this set of DoD contracts that have the CUI 7012 stipulation. And that's a problem for universities. My contention is that actually makes those operations for those DoD contracts less secure than they would if we were using our well-versed and well-practiced processes to keep them safe. Mm-hmm. So I have a lot of concerns about how that's going to play out in the near future.
I think it's also important to remember too, just like the DoD contracts and come in many shapes and sizes and flavors, one contract could be dealing with multiple different sets of regulations, each of them with their own reporting requirements when an incident occurs. And so for UArizona, we've got a small army of compliance partners that oversee their respective areas. Who reports on what and how the incident is managed is going to depend on the project, the incident, who was involved, and all those other details. That's why it's difficult to have a one set process to say, we're going to this person is going to handle it. It really does take a team to manage our municipality and the different things that we've got going on. But this is where it's also very important for higher education institutions to have a centralized authority for things like CUI in being able to say, this is where the buck stops. You can have this army of people who are responsible for taking in incident reporting, for working with the compliance partners, for managing the CUI enclaves. But there needs to be somebody at the top that does answer for when things go awry.
For example, like here, you can't just go to, say, your HIPAA security officer or the person who holds your medium assurance certificate and say, hey, we have an incident, go report it. Leadership needs to be involved, or representatives that are able to say something. And Colin, to kind of go on your point of the separate process, we've had to do that here as well, where we have a separate, essentially, process for incident handling and reporting for DoD contracts out of necessity, just because it's shifting a bit from what we traditionally do to make sure that we're following exactly what needs to happen. I mean, it's not a great shift, but it's enough of a shift to where we have to have this other defined process.
And getting back a bit to one of the comments that Wendy made about things in the decentralization and the central piece. Centrally, you know, the IT security team at Duke is charged with keeping an eye on everything. But what we don't know necessarily is if we see that there's a potential compromise on a given box in a unit, we have no way of knowing at that point in time what data might be on that particular box, and therefore, by extension, what's in play in terms of reporting requirement. I mean, it's easier if you think about things that we might do in an enclave, but going back to the breadth of things we do research at a university across everything. And sometimes it's even personally owned devices. Sometimes it's university managed devices. And so part of this thing is how quickly can we identify what's in play on things. And so some of it we will do a much closer job because of the contractual obligations as to knowing what's that. But every time that there is an incident, one of the big things is to quickly identify what's there and who needs to be involved.
Okay, well, that's all very interesting. Let's shift into the drivers for cybersecurity compliance at a university. Can you tell us about some of those? Obviously, NIST 800-171 and CMMC is one of them. One question I will ask is, do you think that it took the threat of CMMC's third-party assessment for folks to really start taking it seriously?
In my personal opinion, I say the answer is no, because when the Defense Federal Acquisition Regulation Supplement 7012 clause triggered compliance with 800-171 by December 31st of 2017. UArizona, at least I can say for that, we formed a team of about 15 to 20 people, give or take. And I was part of that team when the Cybersecurity and Maturity Model Certification Framework was first launched in 2019. It really didn't have a significant impact for us. You know, this is just part of the evolution, if you will, of what started back in 2015 with the DFARS 7012 clause.
Exactly. Like I mentioned, in 2015, we did something very similar to the University of Arizona. Here at the University of Notre Dame, the research group came to the IT folks and said, here's the new regulation. We are already familiar with being compliant with regulations, and we threw it in the hopper with the rest of the regulations, and we did what we do. I think that's pretty common theme for universities.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you know, this might change by the time this gets aired, but it like doesn't exist yet. It won't exist until rulemaking happens. These drivers, these regulatory drivers, it's really 171 that is the standard that is defined by those regulatory drivers. So you've got the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act, or GLBA. That's another regulatory driver, but it points to 800-171 as the standard in which security needs to be achieved or compliance needs to be achieved.
And one point I'll make, Jacob, going back to your question, is part of what the driver is how your research portfolio is actually distributed in terms of funding agencies. So for the schools where DoD funding is a large portion of their, it took, I think, a higher priority. I know it certainly did at my previous institute at Duke. NIH is probably the largest single funding agency for research here. And so you tend to focus on what you're beholden to in terms of where the most of your money is. And so drivers vary from institute to institute, which in turn, I think, has driven how forward-thinking and proactive a university has been with respect to 800-171 specifically. At Duke, we don't have a large portfolio of things that have actually risen above the fundamental research threshold. And so we're there, we're building to it, we know about it, but it's not like we have nearly the dollar value on the line, they say, that perhaps Wendy does out at University of Arizona. So those things are factors as well. So once we hit spun up these two groups that I mentioned earlier, the 800-171 community group at EDUCAUSE and the regulator research community of practice, what got created on the side that kind of supported all of this was a Slack discussion group that many of us are participating in. And that kind of became the feeder for whoever saw something said something. And so somewhere along the line, this National Presidential Memorandum, NSPM 33, suddenly arises. And the first things you start picking out of it are, well, it's going to apply to everybody who's got more than $50 million in annual funding from the federal government for research. And we kind of looked around the room and said, well, that's going to be all of us. And so we started digging into, well, what is this actually going to look like? And so, you know, over a course of discussion, and as these things come up, they typically get folded into the ongoing discussions that take place in both groups. And it's like, what does this mean? What do we see out of it? And so, you know, at conferences, it would be an actual topic of discussion. What are the implications? What do we think this is going to look like? Mm-hmm. To a lot of us, I think that particular one looks a lot like CMMC level one. Some of the same controls, you can do the same matching. Doesn't mm-hmm. seem to be all that onerous from a control standpoint for the most part, except for one small particular gotcha. And that is when you start looking at some of the reporting pieces that are required that would be non-issues on an institute-managed machine, there's no way that you would be able to easily make a personally owned device compliant. And coming from a small business, you're probably thinking, well, why would your personally owned device ever be part of this equation to begin with? And I think what most people outside of higher education don't recognize is that the bulk of the research, day-to-day research activities are carried out by our graduate students. And the bulk of our graduate students do that work, effort, computational parts, largely on their personally owned laptops. That's just the way it evolved in terms of universities being able to get their hands on compute without actually having to make the investment in compute. And if you look at the hue and cry of the cost of higher education going up and going up, well, that was one way that you could kind of hold things down because you're not having to buy as much compute. I think some of us who've looked at NSPM 33 say, if it came down and was enforced as is currently written, that could call into the question to be the ability to do any of that federal research on personally owned laptops.
And just as a side note, if you're not able to self-certify that you're compliant with NSPM 33 as it's currently written, you can no longer continue, so maintain, or receive new federal funding. That's pretty massive.
Yeah, that is really critical. Wow. Are there any other regulatory cyber policies, rules, legislation that's coming that you all have your eye on?
There is. I'm going to hope that Wendy or somebody has got the actual name of it. There's one that came up in the last couple of weeks that's got our attention because it starts talking about incident reporting requirements that would be a lot more stringent than what we're looking at. I think if we look at the current situation with NIST 800-171, if I'm not mistaken, and experts here in the room will correct me if I'm wrong, I think we've got a 72-hour window under 7012. This new piece, which could supersede that one and apply across a much broader section of the government, has us facing down an 8-hour requirement, which would be nearly impossible in our current operations. I don't know that any of us are running our own 24/7 SOC. That would be problematic. And then there's also, on top of that 8-hour, there's this whole, and you must give us hourly updates on your incident response process. So instead of working the incident, we're going to have to devote resources to figuring out what we're going to tell somebody at CISA every hour. So that's got our attention.
I think it's also, too, depending on where your footprint is in the world, organizations, whether it's a higher ed or industry, need to also be mindful of some of the other nuances with international regulations. GDPR, for example, has Article 42, which is similar to CMMC in that it requires a third-party assessment organization to certify an organization's compliance with the regulation. So that's something that needs to be monitored. You have other countries like Europe, Australia, Singapore, Paraguay, Canada, they all have cybersecurity frameworks that could impact what's happening depending on where that footprint is at. And so those need to be examined as well. We can't stay in our own little US bubble.
We've got a campus in China, for example. So you can just imagine what comes along with that.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Something else that's interesting too is the United States, the different states are passing all these different privacy laws. Each one is a bit different. And then there's a federal privacy law that's being worked on. I don't know if it's on hold or not. You know, some have compared it to GDPR. The approach is different, but I mean, all of these various regulations, laws are coming. And I think it's, even as a small business, I think it's so critical that we keep an eye on the regulatory landscape and just make sure we know what's coming so we can hopefully future-proof our compliance programs across the board.
That's very true too, because you've got the CIS critical security controls. And some would say that CIS controls were a precursor to CMMC, because they're a prescriptive, prioritized, and simplified set of best practices, but now complicate not just the fact that you've got a federal regulation that's coming about CMMC, right? We've got DFARS clauses and FAR clauses that we have to watch out for. But now there are several states out there, which include, but aren't limited to California, Colorado, Michigan, Idaho, that have legislation that leverage CIS controls. So depending even where your footprint is at within the United States, you may have these other pieces that we talked about before where states get involved and you have to start to manage and balance those as well. And then I think, Colin, you referred to it as before, but anybody who works in compliance, you know that you usually have to take the most restrictive control and apply it in order to be able to meet everything else, right? So it's very complicated.
Hey, everybody, it's Future Jake here. And I just wanted to take a moment to talk about my first podcast sponsor, Keeper Security. I've been using Keeper's Password Manager for a few years now. And what really got my attention was their focus on security and compliance. Fast forwarding to today, they're now FedRAMP moderate authorized and also have their own FIPS 140 validated encryption module, which I think is quite impressive. After years of using Keeper myself, it's become one of my favorite security tools, and I recently learned even more about it by helping document the CMMC requirements that Keeper satisfies. And speaking of CMMC, Keeper is hosting a webinar on April 4th to show how defense contractors can securely share sensitive information using Keeper. So be sure to check that out. If you're looking for a password manager, I highly recommend taking a look at Keeper. You can support GRC Academy by using the links below. Thanks and enjoy the rest of the episode. Well, I'd like to get your thoughts on the Penn State False Claims Act lawsuit that was issued. And when I was looking at it, I could just feel the frustration of the author, you know, trying to do the right thing, trying to make everything happen, but they just weren't able to for some reason. Can you give some general thoughts on why it went the way it did and then maybe share some lessons learned for other universities who could be in the same boat?
I'll take a crack at it, and I'll start by saying all of us feel for our colleagues who find themselves in these situations. And I don't know that you can look at this and say malicious intent. I think one of the things that we struggled with and have been working on is it can be difficult to take these compliance and security considerations and translate them into the language that connects with leadership at a university and connecting the dots as to what the implications are going to be. I think a lot of times it's unfortunate, but the reality is that historically there's been a lot of check the box and get the work going approach to doing research. And I think most of us recognize that just isn't going to fly, but they're certainly not the only ones who faced either having a problem or have actually been fined somewhere along the way. It's just that those things don't get highly publicized. This one, I think, perhaps has, but it becomes a case of at least this has people to start this discussion. What do we need to do to not find ourselves in a similar situation? And so I think the silver lining in it is I think this time around, I've had more of a sense that leadership at institutions recognized that this was a problem that they could find themselves in and were interested in figuring out what is it we need to do to not be in that situation.
My dad used to say, out of bad comes good. And while I don't think any of us here are happy that an institution made the headlines in a negative light like this. The story does back up with what Jen was saying. It provides us with the example we need to show how seriously executive leadership within our respective institutions need to take compliance with the contracts. We engage with different government offices and the regulatory requirements associated with those contracts. So while it's not something maybe we want to celebrate, at the same time, it does give us that poster child, if you will, of what not to do.
And we're probably better positioned today because all of this effort we've made over the past few years of saying who needs to be in the room and aware of things around this. Most of us have networks, though, that when we get something like a Penn State story, we can just turn around and fire off an email and put that in front of everybody who should be aware and thinking about what the implications of that are. We don't have to hope that maybe it got to them through other channels. We can put it in that channel ourselves.
Right. And that's a springboard for discussions. We've been describing these complicated systems with many, many requirements, a lot of regulation everywhere you turn. And for senior leadership, this is a problem that they're confronting all the time, every day. And without an example like this and people like the ones in this discussion to be able to bring the problems to light so that all can understand, we need to continue to do that work. For me, from a technical standpoint, you know, I know how to secure things. Mm-hmm. That's not a problem. We know what to do. It's getting there. And that getting there depends on those discussions and that mutual understanding.
What would you say needs to happen to affect cybersecurity change at a university? Again, for those folks that are struggling.
One of the things is you need to figure out who's going to listen and take direction from whom. It won't work if at a university they decide, well, this is all a bunch of cybersecurity compliance stuff. So we're going to let our cybersecurity and compliance folks talk about it and hope that it resonates with our faculty who are doing the research. It's making sure that the right message comes from the right place. Now, that may involve us helping the people who the faculty will listen to develop that message and get it worded in a way that'll make sense. That's part of it. Another part of it is going to be the difficulty that smaller educational institutions face that fortunately some of us on the phone or on the call here don't have. We've got a large cybersecurity group, but we've got smaller schools that we will collaborate with that simply don't have the infrastructure or staffing to do all of the things that we see coming. And yet they have many of the same obligations in there. You know, they're all processing credit cards. They're all doing student financial aid. And so as each of these things ramp up, I really do feel for any of my colleagues who work at a smaller university and wear many hats because they're just overwhelmed in the workload that has to be carried out. So
there's two things that I think of for affecting cybersecurity change. 85 to 95% of cybersecurity breaches are caused by human-enabled behaviors. So if we want to see a change, it needs to start with each individual being more diligent in practicing good cyber hygiene. You know, pay close attention to those external emails. Don't use your USB data transfer port on your computer to charge your cell phone, right? Be on the lookout for those suspicious behaviors. And if you make a mistake, report it, you know, so that the issue can be addressed sooner rather than later. But the strengthened posture is now something that you can market to say, hey, you can trust us with your information.
I think there's been a significant amount of change in terms of the awareness of cybersecurity at all levels in our personal lives, in our business lives. It comes every day. It smacks you in the face the minute you turn on your favorite news source or open that letter from your bank or from your insurance company or your gaming company or whoever that says, oh, by the way, we spilled your data. I don't know about you guys, but I've had 6 new credit cards this year. So it's a reality that it's unavoidable in any part of your life. I think that's contributed to better awareness. Still lots of training to do, but the world is training people for us in a way.
I do feel at times like a puppet master working behind the scenes, whispering in different people's ears to get them to parrot things, right? To get them to share the message. Because ultimately, if it's not coming from leadership, and if it's not coming from, say, your like security champions or those who are influential within your institution itself, then no amount of training really even, you could train and train and train and train. And at a certain point, it's diminishing returns. Like your repeat offenders. So what are you going to do about your repeat offenders? What are you going to do about the person who always clicks on that email, right? There's a link, got to click on it, right? I think there's different approaches. As far as getting change at our institution, it really had to come up from the top uppermost levels, essentially saying, hey, we think this is important. We think that effort needs to be put in this direction. You have our support. We are going to say no to these things. Because without that, it's almost impossible to, unless you have a truly diligent lab or work, like group of researchers that actually want to do the right thing and are technically confident enough to understand what they're doing, right? Like, and that's rare. That's very rare. I've only had a small number of cases with labs where they came forward and they're like, hey, we have this. We've noticed this. We want to be more secure. This is what we want to do. Like, that's hard because it's cybersecurity is overhead and it's work. And it's having to think about every single thing that you're doing.
Right.
It is. And I think at the C-suite level, you really have to appeal to them on the basis of risk and the cost of not managing those risks correctly. And that's sort of a new thing for cybersecurity. In my 25 years, there hasn't been a big emphasis on that. But like I said, you look at your news source every day and you see what the outcome of not having good cyber hygiene will result in. The risk analysis of the systems that we have, the people that use those systems, those need to start to become a higher priority for cybersecurity, so that people at higher levels in an institution can understand what the problem is.
Yeah, great points, everyone. Thank you so much for that. Now, let's move on to talking about how we actually secure and what we secure in the NIST 800-171 context. Typically, there's two approaches to do it, network-wide, or you establish an enclave, an isolated island, and secure that and apply those controls to that and actually have the data inside of that enclave.
So we're never going to get our entire campus to be 800-171 compliant. So we push that out. And you simply cannot do all of the research that we're talking about in the enclave. Mm-hmm. So for example, I may have a physical specimen that is CUI. The object itself is CUI. And I may need to go into a lab and run a bunch of engineering stress tests and things of that nature, or take some measurements of that particular item, and that can't be done in an enclave. I mean, you might argue, well, we'll put the instrument in the enclave and somehow we'll just make it part of that. Then we get back to what Colin was talking about. Any of these things that we have, especially, say, a scanning electron microscope, just to take an example, typically is used by more than one group at the university. And the bulk of its work, I'll wager, is actually outside of the CUI thing. So We aren't going to be Noah's Ark. We're not going to have two of everything. We may be forced into having two of some things, but we're not going to have two of everything. And so there are cases where we're going to have to identify ways to deal with that middle ground between everything is somehow magically certified, not happening, or we're just going to do it in an enclave, because we'll get as much as we can in the enclave. And we're always looking for creative ways to keep the actual CUI. A lot of this is going to come down to how we manage what is actually CUI and define it, and where can we keep something from perhaps being CUI until it absolutely has to be. So perhaps if I'm taking a bunch of measurements of that physical object still CUI. Okay, so it has to be locked up in a cabinet in the lab and only certain people have access to it. Fine, we've protected the CUI. But perhaps the instrument readings that we took on that sample are meaningless if we don't know what they apply to. And perhaps then, now we've managed to magically get our scanning electron microscope out of the equation. We may still have to keep people out of the room when we're actually taking those measurements, coordinate some of the physical security around that. But perhaps we can take the data security piece and move it further. Maybe we take all that data, get it over in our enclave and handle it in the enclave. So I think most of us are are focused on getting our enclaves in order and figuring out what we're going to do there. But we have to look at each project's individual workflow to even start determining what are the things we need in the enclave, because invariably a research project is going to come along and require something that you're not already doing in that enclave. And the question then becomes, can I add that component inside of my enclave without voiding the SSP that I already have that I defined for this enclave? I mean, that's another thing. We don't know what's going to happen at a university 2 years from now, 18 months from now. This SP and the CMMC process isn't something that we'll be able to do, you know, every time a new project comes along. Well, we'll just get the assessor in here and get this certified and get going. So that's one of the things that we've got to think about.
And, you know, if you look at the CMMC scoping guide for level two, you're going to see that there are five different asset types. And one of those asset types is security protection assets. So that includes not just the technology, like the enclave, the cloud-based environment where CUI information is being processed, stored, or transmitted, but it also means the people and the facilities that are involved in handling or conducting CUI. So it is more than just technology that is involved in protecting CUI.
Yes. And Jay, you were talking about different types of instruments that would fall under that specialized assets, CMMC asset category, I think. What are some of the other specialized research tools out there that universities are using?
I think anything that has to be done in a laboratory.
Anything that's not your it's your Frankenstein creation. It's anything that's not standard, anything that needs a third party to actually update, right? Things that are required for research that legitimately can't function within and meet all the 800-171 controls.
For example, we've got a project where the researcher needs to use a DSLR camera, basic camera. I've got one I do astrophotography with. But because they're using that camera to take pictures and that information has been deemed as CUI, that regular commercial grade camera now has to be treated with the protections under 800-171 or CUI because of this project. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's not something that can be done in the cloud, but how do you get now the pictures off of that camera and into the environment and share it securely with the sponsor or others that are involved? So these are those nuances, and it's not just something that's going to remain in a virtual space.
The University of Notre Dame has a facility that has several wind tunnels. Those wind tunnels could be utilized to test any number of different objects. It could be a CUI covered object, or it might not be. So to Jay's point, you want to make sure that you're understanding when that data is contextualized. If, for example, I had something on in a wind tunnel, and I got a discrete measurement like 600 miles an hour at 10:42.2 in the afternoon, 200 degrees. How can that be CUI, right? So you have to take these things apart, look at them individually, and understand what your process is. And if you then zoom out to 800-171, there's not going to be anything in 800-171 that specifies how you do that, because it's impossible to anticipate all these little nuances and all these little variations in how the research is going to get done. By definition, impossible, because next year's research facility hasn't been built yet, maybe even thought of yet. And yet we still have to apply these same 110 controls to all of those things. It's a group effort. The people that need the research, the people doing the research, the people that have the ability to secure the research all need to understand each other.
And Colin just mentioned something that is a real critical component. One of the things that I figured out early on in doing this is it was very helpful to me to actually have an engineering degree as my actual educational background. I understood research. I had worked supporting research. I was able to sit down with a faculty, and it didn't matter what discipline the actual research was in. I knew enough to be able to ask questions about the workflow to understand what that scoping starts to look like and to tease out what are going to be the actual needs from a data flow perspective, from a computational perspective. And so all of these things has to be done pretty much on a per project basis. You've kind of got to go and get this bill of what's needed from all of that. And so this is an ongoing effort. Every time you onboard a project, and that's one of the things we're working on at Duke, is making that onboarding such and opening it up, going back to that workflow comment I made, having that in a place and making sure that you ask enough questions up front that you can streamline that process. I learned through trial and error and doing this repetitively that I could take what was typically an hour-long onboarding conversation with a faculty member down to 30 if I sent them this questionnaire up front that asked them some of those basic questions. And then I knew a little bit about the research when I sat down with them, and the conversation was more about filling in the blanks and what they had told me that I still felt needed to be addressed. But those are the sorts of, you know, things that we're figuring out as we go along and then trying to turn around and share with our colleagues to say, hey, this is what we're doing. This is what's working. And then you tweak it to make it work in your environment.
That's a big part, right, of handling operational technology is for us is developing the procedures around its use, making sure there's something that they're putting together so that we can audit it later to make sure that they are in some way following the procedures that they're putting together. Mm-hmm. So a lot of time for some of our specific tech that is evaluating CUI in some way, they have a plan that they're supposed to put together and send out to get approval prior to using that. It's more overhead because it's a, you know, it's administrative burden to make sure that the procedure that they're proposing is actually adequately protecting their stuff, but it's what we have in place right now to try and be compliant with 800-171.
I was just going to note that you don't have to be an engineer like Jay to understand these things. My background is in business. I've got a bachelor in global business and a master in regulatory trade compliance. It's about asking the questions so that you can understand what it is that's happening and what's going on. And that's where my compliance background for the last 15 years has helped, is help me understand what it is that you're doing, what it is that you need to do so that I can advise you, is export controls in play? Where do we need to address something in information security? So this isn't about having the technical acuity to understand what needs to be done. It's about having that general understanding of what needs to be done so that you can apply those standards and those controls that need to be met.
Are isolated systems, we'll call them CUI enclaves, but are isolated systems for you all a new thing? Because you all have so many compliance and regulations that you already have to meet. Is this new for you all?
In a way.
Not entirely.
Yeah, in a way it is, but similar things have already existed. I know at Notre Dame, when I started, we had a PCI network that was isolated from the rest of the network. Why? Because it was regulated in a way the rest of the network wasn't. So no, it's not the first time, but you know, 110 throws PCI in a cocked hat. It's a lot more difficult.
Yeah, and PCI is a great example because PCI, it's a set of known transactions and operations that take place. And so once you've done one store and set it up and got it on the network, and you put the next dining hall or whatever operation in there, it's the same workflow process time over time. 171, the wrinkle is no two projects look the same.
And the other thing too is research itself is becoming more and more sophisticated. And depending on the institution, the kind of research that is being done can throw a wrinkle into things as well. While we started out in 2T with what goes into the enclave is staying in the enclave, but now we're learning how to shift some of the types of research, such as space missions. That's a big thing out in Arizona. So how do we deal with the session timeouts that have to occur when you need to leave the communication flow open for 16, 24 hours or more? in order for the satellite to download the information to the server. So I think part of what we're seeing here that's new is how to deal with these nuances.
And will you see a single CUI enclave, or will there be multiple in a university?
I think it depends. It depends on leadership. Who at the top says, yeah, we need two environments. Me personally, I don't know what the advantage would be over having multiple environments. I mean, why build a Noah's Ark of enclaves if you don't have to?
One of the things, and we start talking about things that maybe didn't exist 5, 7, 8 years ago when all of this started, I can think of one example where that starts to come into question. And that is, let's say we've got our local on-premise enclaves running traditional virtual machines and say a VMware Citrixy type of environment. Now we've got researchers who are using functions and things in cloud computing that you simply can't replicate on on-prem system. And so maybe you don't want to run everything to the cloud, but you may have some workflow that needs to be in one of the GovCloud regulated instances as well as an on-prem effort. So I agree with Wendy. I don't think necessarily any of us want to get in the business of having 5 different enclaves that are kind of all doing the same thing to the extent possible. We'd like to put everything in. If you said, Jake, can you wave a magic wand, what would you like? I'd like the DoD to actually set up an enclave with a couple of the major cloud providers and just simply sell it and rent it off as space so that, you know, let's say Colin's got a research project. Colin, let's say the four of us have a research project we're collaborating on, and we all need to access the same data and we need to do different parts of the project. It sure would be nice if there was a GovCloud instance that we all had a tenancy in and could actually go there, do our work, and let someone else manage making sure that I get access to what I need, Melissa gets access to what she needs, Wendy gets access to her stuff, Colin gets access to his stuff, and the exchange. Because then we're not building out 4 variations of the same thing and then trying to figure out how we're going to plug them together. And honestly, that's one of the biggest headaches all of us face outside of the stuff that we do. There's a lot of collaboration at a university that goes and extends with partner universities. And when this starts falling with a CUI project spanning multiple universities, that's where it gets interesting. That's where it gets difficult as you try and move things around.
And another advantage behind that thought process, Jay, is the cost, right? One of the challenges that our researchers have is being able to account for what these costs are going to be against their project. If the DoD develops something along the lines of what Jay's has described here, we know what the cost would be, and then that cost can be built into the proposals and can be budgeted for. So right now, do we spend several hundred thousand dollars to enhance our current enclave, or do we spend even more hundreds of thousands of dollars that are required to establish a new enclave that can do a little bit more or handle a little bit more or covers an entire building, whatever the case may be. And we're just constantly throwing good money after another to be able to stay on top of everything. So yeah, a centralized source.
I think small business would benefit from that as well.
Absolutely.
One of the strategies that we're using now is for not necessarily for regulated research, but for all kinds of research, is if there's a data set that you need, you making a copy of that data set and bringing it in for whatever processing you're going to do may not be the best choice. The best choice may be your use of that data goes on where that data lives. So if we're talking about it from a risk or a security standpoint, one copy of that data is probably safer than two. So in a very
or four or five.
This is the problem with once you've got a contract, if you're going to sub that contract out, now you're talking about dividing up that data and you're running those risks.
How are you all approaching SSPs for these different projects? Is it a separate SSP per project, or is it one SSP for the environment where the project will be operating inside of?
Yes and
our
yes.
Our approach right now, yes and, yeah, yes, and yes. Yes. We're looking to do an enclave level SSP and then define how, you know, an individual project can be in there, and then that would apply to everything. And then those one-offs that we've talked about earlier that have to be done in other locations obviously need to be their own separate SSPs. But I don't think we'll be, we may generate a copy, and there may be language in the SSP specific to the project itself. But I think the actual boilerplate that covers most of the controls for things in the enclave will be the same from one to the next.
One thing that we've been exploring in our SSP, because we have, so we've had historically had one per enclave where that reflects the evolution of our compliance journey, or it reflects our compliance journey. But what we've been exploring is sectioning off our SSP for every control, so that in some ways it, try to think of the word for it, but it
so you're going to componentize the
componentize SSPs? It. Yeah, basically, we're doing some information science on this beast. I'm from a background in databases. This is like when I look at SSPs, they make my eyes bleed, because it just would be much simpler if, and anyways, and there have been some attempts by NIST, and I forgot the project, but essentially to make it more of like a Git repository where you have like an XML based, and I don't know if you're familiar with these things, but kind of like, anyways, tagging things so that you can pull these tags and then make different forms of SSPs from a larger data set. Like, I'm going to query this and I want this subset. That would be wonderful. That's something I would like to have in the future. But right now we're working from kind of one large SSP that's like a Word document.
What are some areas in NIST 800-171, DFARS, CMMC that you hope the government will change, or some areas that really need to be clarified that really impact you all?
I can say one big one. At the contract stage, just have it understood between the contracting officer that at the onset, we're going to carefully enumerate what the markings are on the contract with technical staff. That's step one. Before the contract is even signed. Hey, if it's with a research institution, fundamental research, let us know if that's even an option at the very beginning. Just being open to that and then having that be integrated and assume that it's going to be part of the process would eliminate a lot of headache of having to go and say, hey, can you please do this? Hey, can you look at this? So just if that's just standard, it would make things easier, because then it helps us scope a lot better, like down the line once the contract is accepted. That's a big one that I can think about off the top of my head.
I think for me, I recognize that higher education is just a very small portion of the defense industrial base, but the culture and the structure of higher education is different from our industry partners, with whom the primary organizations that CMMC and NIST 800-171 have been designed for. Or basically the square peg being forced into a round hole. And so while NIST and the DoD say that they have consulted with higher education partners, I'm just not seeing where the nuances of higher education environments have been addressed appropriately in the things that have been published. So it's almost like they want higher ed to conform to the way industry works. And that's just not realistic. So I would like to see publications, true verbiage that addresses the nuances of higher education. There are versions of clauses that can be inserted for higher education use. And I think I'd like to see some of those be adopted for CMMC or for 800-171 that might be helpful to us in the way that we work.
I think to that point, Wendy's right. One of the things that we don't currently have with things slated the way they are is we can't do much in the way of tailoring things to be appropriate for any specific project. We don't have the flexibility. So I think most of us look at CM and the, you know, everything is done or it doesn't work. as being a little rigid and inflexible to give us the ability to get around a sticky point, to be able to say, okay, in this particular case, for these specific reasons, what can we do? And the going back to the comment I made earlier, we aren't going to be able to go back to the CMMC table and say, hey, we need an update or a look at this. We get one swat at this probably to get our enclaves certified. I think many of us are saying, we are really not sure what this is going to mean for the project that comes around, 18 months from now and is going to want to use a lab that is being built 6 months from now. Mm-hmm. There's no way we can start an SST for any of that. So we can't have an SSP. And if we can't have an SSP, we can't get CE certified, which means when we get to the point where CMMC is required in order to put in a proposal, if we get to that point, how's that going to work?
It's the chicken and the egg.
It is the chicken and the egg.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the things that I had a discussion with a former contracting officer for the Navy at a recent conference. And, as a lowly cybersecurity person, I said, I have the know-how to secure the things that you're saying are CUI. However, you're not being very clear about what's CUI. And it feels like there's a rubber stamp that goes on things that says, oh, I must designate this, I must declare this to be CUI. And that doesn't help any. What that does is it confounds the problem. There's no specificity there. There's nothing that says, oh, no, I don't mean what color clothes you wear in the lab. That's not the CUI. It's the object that you created and that you're testing. That's the CUI. And in this conversation, I said, it's possible that people will have to sit down and figure out for themselves which is CUI and which isn't. And as a former contracting officer, would that be your expectation? And this single contracting officer can't speak for any others. Former contracting officer said, yes, that seems reasonable. And if you have questions about what that is, contracting officer will need to bring in a subject matter expert of their own and have that conversation. I would like for there to be an easier way to get that conversation started, for that conversation to be the norm rather than the exception.
Talking about lessons learned that you would like to share, are there any that really come to mind as in this really helped us overcome a particular hurdle?
I think Jay brought up a good one. When you start after the contract, when you're just working with a researcher, having either a set of questions, particularly revolving around data flow to help scope what they're doing. That is a big one. It really helps with streamlining the process with the researcher because you can't help the researcher without understanding where the data is going and what systems they intend for it to be in.
And then couple that with what Colin just said about getting clearer markings out of the contract to begin with. I mean, those two pieces coupled together with, I mean, the researcher can tell you what their workflow is, but if the researcher doesn't have documentation that allows them to easily understand what parts of what they've signed on to do are actually CUI, where it's just they've thrown it in there and they haven't specified anything other than to say it applies. That's not very helpful. So if we get both of those things kind of working together, we may get this down to smaller workflows that are much more easy to identify, scope, and move on to the next thing.
I also think whether another university or an industry partner, compliance with NIST 800-171 is an ongoing effort. This is not a checklist of got it, you're done. This is a shared responsibility approach from the end user to the system administrator to the managed service provider. Everyone needs to be at the table and taking an active role to ensure compliance is being achieved and maintained. So yeah, this is not a simple, got it, and we're done, move on.
Right. This is a 3-year cycle. As Jay said, things will change in that 3 years before your next CMMC audit. If you're not tracking those changes, and to me, this was a lesson I learned pretty recently as we had a significant change to a system that wasn't actually subject to CUI, but it made me reflect on that in our CUI enclave. Hey, as those changes come through, you get new versions of software, you switch out the hardware, you may reconfigure what's the maximum network speed. I'm installing all new equipment so I can go gig. All of those things need to be reflected in the system security plan. They need to be reflected in the documentation that brings that system security plan alive. That is no small matter. I'm just starting to wake up to how big a matter that actually is.
And that brings up the other point, right? Security maturity model certification. You don't need all 110 out of the gate, right? But you do need a minimum of 88. So where over the next 3 years are you maturing and evolving your practices in order to either enhance what you already have, if you're meeting all 100, or moving the needle, so to speak, to achieving 110. So this is, it is ongoing.
Yeah. Well, excellent, excellent points. I want to thank you all so much for this opportunity and wish you all a great weekend. And thankfully it's Friday. Thank God, right? Just want to thank you all so
much.
Thanks
for having us.
Yeah. Thanks, Jacob.